The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Based on the great feedback I got yesterday on what we did yesterday, I decided to repeat the class. No, I'm just joking. But what I decided to do is a number of people expressed interest in further exploring this notion of majestic man, Adam 1, and the man of faith, Adam 2. And so what I've put together is, again, some edited pieces from Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, The Lonely Man of Faith, so that we will explore in greater depth the meaning of redemption. Remember what we talked about yesterday. We talked about how Adam 1, remember when we talk about Adam 1 and Adam 2, these are not two people. This is one human being. And these are two tendencies, contradictory tendencies within the human being. And so Soloveitchik calls it Adam 1 and Adam 2, but he ultimately gives Adam 1 the name Majestic Man. Because Adam 1 is seeking a status of majesty. Adam 1 created the image of God, creating the image particularly of Elohim, which is the name of God as we know God as a creator, right? Adam 1 wants to be a creator too. Elohim is a ruler. Elohim is the source of all power. And therefore, man created in the image of Elohim cannot help but want to have power and control. And therefore, the mandate, the assignment, the mission of Adam 1 is to rule the environment as much as a human being can, to have control over the environment, to harness the elemental forces, right, and ascend the ladder of somewhat of a kingly position in this world. And therefore, he talks about how Adam 1, he is motivated to be dignified. Okay? He seeks dignity. And this based on the verse in Tehillim, saying that, God, you have made the human being just a little less than Elohim. Right? You have crowned him with kavod. And kavod is glory, kavod is honor, kavod is dignity. Okay? So we describe dignity as something based on a social behavior. Dignity is something in terms of the way others see you. A dignified existence is an existence whereby you are able to distinguish yourself from the natural world and ascend the ladder in terms of the ranks of having a dignified position. Alright? Rav Soloveitchik talks about dignity being a life which exudes or demonstrates orderliness, cleanliness, beauty. And therefore, Adam 1, who seeks dignity, is aesthetic. Adam 1, who seeks dignity, is organized. And Adam 1, who seeks dignity, is in control as much as human being is possible of the environment. Okay? And he seeks more and more and more control. And therefore, Adam 1, who is majestic man, is practical minded. Adam 1, who is majestic man, is technical minded. And Adam 1, when he sees the cosmos, what he asks is, how can I replicate this? How can I understand this so I can harness the power in it? Adam 1, majestic man, looks at the world like a big tool chest. And says, what are the tools that I can use from this world in order to advance myself and achieve greater power and greater control? That is Adam 1, and that isn't bad. And that's what's very important. That's very, very much what we've been mandated to do. That's a side of ourselves, to be creative, to be in control. And that's a very valid, valid approach. But then Rav Soloveitchik demonstrates to us, and from the text, that there's another side to the human being, which he calls Adam 2. And Adam 2 is the man of faith. Okay? Adam 2 has a completely different issue. Adam 1, when he looks at the cosmos, he asks, how? But Adam 2, when he looks at the cosmos, he asks, why? What for? What is it? What's its purpose? And therefore, Adam 2, the man of faith, he struggles with his existential value. He struggles with I, not in terms of what I do, but he struggles with I in terms of who I am. And he sees himself not in terms of functionality, but in terms of mere naked existence. And so today, and so Rav Soloveitchik says that Adam too is motivated towards redemption. And today we're going to define in a deeper way the meaning of redemption. Adam 1, majestic man, seeks dignity. Adam 2, the man of faith, seeks redemption. And so I'm going to hand out the sheet, and we begin to read. There are two basic distinctions between dignity and cathartic redemptiveness. Catharsis is a relieving experience. It's a cleansing, purging experience. It's a, you know, it's like oy vey. You know what I mean? When you're in a certain position, you go, oy. Okay? And that's redemptiveness, Rav Soloveitchik refers to as a cathartic redemption. Being redeemed is unlike being dignified, an ontological awareness. Redemption is an ontological awareness. What does ontological mean? Ontological is the nature of being. Okay? It's the nature of being. In other words, to be redeemed is an awareness of my suchness, my isness, not my business, but my isness. It's an awareness of the nature and quality of my being, in contrast to dignity, which is an awareness of what I have accomplished, what I own. There's a very nice book by Eric Fromm, and a number of his books are draw from a lot of Jewish ideas. He grew up in a religious home, and he was taught by rabbis. Later in his life, apparently, he in some way dropped it. To what extent, they don't know. But Eric Fromm is a psychologist, wrote a number of books. He wrote one book called To Be or To Have. And, and that, I think, is a good terminology. Redemption has to do with being. And dignity has to do with what you have, in terms of, I have power, I have status, I have property. But now we're talking about who I am. So it's my I am-ness. It's not just an extraneous, accidental attribute among other attributes of being, but a definite mode of being itself. That's what redemption is. It's a mode of being. It's not a mode of acting. It's a mode of being. You could be sitting there doing nothing and feeling so redeemed. He hasn't yet told us what that feeling is, but he's telling us that it's certainly not something extraneous. A redeemed existence is intrinsically different from an unredeemed existence. So the distinction between dignity and redemption is being versus having and doing, internal versus external, private versus public. Remember, of Soloveitchik explains that dignity is very much linked to fame and social behavior. There's nobody else around, so what's your dignity mean if there's nobody to see it? But redemption is, I don't need anybody to see. I need to know it. And if I don't know it, nobody knows it. And if nobody knows it, but I know it, well, then I am redeemed still. And therefore, redemptiveness does not have to be acted out vis-a-vis the outside world. Because it doesn't have anything to do with what I do, or what I have, or what people see in external sense. It has to do with what I am, and what I intuit in the inside of my inside. Even a hermit, while not having the opportunity to manifest dignity, can live a redeemed life. Cathartic redemptiveness is experienced in the privacy of one's in-depth personality, and it cuts below the relationship between the I and the thou, to use an existential term, and reaches into the very hidden strata of the isolated I who knows himself as a singular being. Now, what does it mean to know myself as a singular being? He will talk about that later. Right? Part of it has to do with knowing that you are not replicated. There is no duplicate of you. Your experience is your experience, and no matter how much you articulate your pain or joy to somebody else, it's still you experiencing it, it's not them. And that has to do with the loneliness. I mean, that is the source of the loneliness. There's a place within us where our I-ness and our experiences and our intuitions are exclusively ours and nobody's else's. As much as I might share it, there'll still be a place where it's I that I'm crying, and it's I that I'm laughing, and it's I that I'm sighing, and it's I that I'm singing. And so, there's a certain isolated I who knows himself as a singular being. When objectified in personal and emotional categories, cathartic redemptiveness expresses itself in the feeling of axiological security. So what will redemptiveness bring me? A tremendous sense of inner security. Inner security. Now what is that? Inner security. You see, when a person loses everything, let's say they have a huge business, very successful business, and one day the whole thing crashes, at that point you lose all your security, because that was your security. And when you lose it, you go into a tremendous state of insecurity. Cathartic redemptiveness is the feeling of security, but an internal existential security, no matter what I have or what I've lost. The fact that I've lost everything does not mean I would kill myself. Why? Because as long as I am, I'm worthy to exist. And this is an experience that a lot of people don't have. This is really, I think, the plague of our generation. You know, I once went into, I was doing fundraising. You learn a lot fundraising. It's no fun, by the way. It's like when my kids once said to me, why is it called fundraising if it's not fun? You know, but anyways. So I got this meeting with this very wealthy, successful, dignified human being, right? And he truly was, and is. And, okay, I got this meeting with this fellow, and we walk in there, and we're sitting there, we're chatting, I'm telling him what we're doing, I'm telling him about what we're learning, the importance of it. All right. I walk into his office, beautiful office. I mean, classy, classy. It's, you know. And he's got antique furniture and paintings on the wall, and the man's wearing this beautiful suit, you know. And we sit down, he turns to me, says, Rabbi, would you like a coffee or tea or something? I said, well, thank you very much. And he reaches underneath the table and he pushes, it wasn't his bubble gum he was sticking under there. He was pushing some kind of button. And in moments, this very attractive secretary shows up. And she says, yes, sir, yes, sir. And he says, two coffees, please. Right? And she says, oh, yes, sir. And she comes back with the coffee and she pours the coffee for him. She pours the coffee for me. She then asks him, sir, would you like some cream? He says, Yes, a teaspoon and a half, please. Okay, so she puts a teaspoon and a half. She says, would you like sugar, sir? Yes, and he gives her exactly the number of granules he wants. And then she says, shall I stir it for you, sir? And he says, yes. And she starts stirring this thing. And I'm looking at this guy saying, wow, what a scene this is. She looks at me. She says, would you like some cream? I said, no, thank you. Like some sugar? I said, no, thank you. She says, shall I stir it for you? I said, there's nothing in it. I'm fine. And she says, okay, fine. So she leaves. And we start talking, and I give him the song and dance, you know, about the meaning of Jewish learning and Torah and the world and I don't know what. Anyways, he turns to me, and he says, Rabbi, don't let all this fool you. I say, what? What? He says, don't let all this fool you. Right? I live with fear every day that I might lose this. I might lose all of this. And therefore, I appreciate what you do, but I'm very limited in my giving, you know. And so I could make, you know, a small token donation. I felt so sorry for the guy, I wrote him an $18 check. Just joking. But it was very sad. But I worry I might lose all this. The truth is that in our society, what most people call securities are really insecurities. What's secure about all this stuff? Right? It's here today, gone tomorrow. But if you place your sense, your, so to speak, ontological value, your existential value in these things, then these are things that are temporal and you can lose it. And you can lose it. Redemptiveness is a cathartic experience. It's an emotional experience. And you're feeling an axiological security. You feel so secure, you're not afraid of losing anything. Because your security isn't based on anything. It's based on your I-ness. Right? It's based on your mere naked existence. I am, and therefore I am valuable. The individual intuits his existence as worthwhile. My mere existence is worthwhile. I don't have expectations that people should relate to me in a worthwhile way because of what I do, or because of what I've accomplished, or because of what I can do for them. But rather, I'm hoping that people will relate to me because I am. And that very fact of existence is incredibly worthwhile. Irregardless of what I do. That I intuit my existence, not my property, my existence is legitimate. What does it mean to be legitimate? Is it legitimate to think that you would give me some of your time, even though there's nothing that I'm going to offer you? Is that legitimate? A lot of people don't feel it's legitimate. You know, who am I to go talk to this person? I have nothing to offer them. Right? There is not a transaction that can take place. And unless there's a transaction that can take place between these two people, between myself and you, I don't feel that anything's legitimate. I don't have a legitimate claim to any kind of attention. I don't have a legitimate right to feel that I'm valuable and adequate, anchored in something stable and unchangeable. I don't have to do something to be loved. Just being. And that's, you know, that's the great thing when you're a kid, because that happens a lot. You know, I'm starting to understand more what childhood was like when I see my own kids, because when my son walks in, and especially at a young age, it's just so easier. Because at 3 years old, your kid can walk in and he's just singing, And you just have this joyful look on your face, and you see him and you give him a big hug. And he doesn't understand, what did I do? You know, like, what did I do? And he just walks in the room and you just, you got this big smile. People have smile. Well, if you're still sensitive, I get nervous when I see people that you can't just look at a child and just smile. And just get tremendous joy of seeing a child. Now, children probably really wonder, like, what did I do? I just walked in the room, didn't I? Right? Oh, maybe I'll do that again. But what is it? It's not what you did. It's just the purity of your being. And at a child's level, you know, I don't know if as children we appreciated how much that is, or maybe if we didn't get it, maybe now we appreciate how much we're missing that existential feeling of legitimate, valuable being. I have an innate sense of my own value. In other words, I don't see myself or my value in terms of some utilitarian way. I don't base my sense of inner value on what I can do or produce or accomplish. I have a deep innate sense of value regardless of whether I'll accomplish or not. They have to understand that Hitler, he killed the insane, right? Why? Why would he go into insane asylums, right? Didn't just kill Jews, he killed people who were insane. Because these are people who are not contributing to the community. Do you follow this? In other words, you don't have an existential value. You have a work value. If you can work, if you can contribute, if you can help me further my interest, even if it's our interest, fine. You have a right to exist. But if there's nothing you can produce, if there's nothing you can do, you don't have a right to exist. And therefore, from his perspective, certainly not a man of faith, he killed people. Because they're not productive. Because they're not productive. They're parasites. But how does a person feel if, God forbid, they couldn't do anything? They lost movement in all their limbs. How does a person feel that way? It's remarkable. Remarkable. I know a story of a fellow who was an athlete and was in a car accident. And he lost all movement in his limbs. And he became a man of faith. And people wondered about that. How do you do that? Where is your bitterness? What, you know? And so somebody had the courage to ask him. I don't know if I would ask. But someone had the courage to ask him. Hey, what's going on? How do you keep going? How is it that you're even able to smile today? Right? I heard a similar story about someone else who remembers seeing a fellow who also lost, he was in a wheelchair, and he told me how he remembers seeing this guy one afternoon, and the man was just sitting there looking at the sky, and he was in such a state of ecstasy. And this fellow came up to him and said, "Hey, what's going on?" And the fellow actually said, "You know, if I was given a choice to go back to where I was before, and I was given back the command of my limbs, I don't know if I'd want to have gone back. I don't know if I'd want to go back." Now, how is it possible that a person could even say such a thing? And the answer is because although he lost his limbs, in that situation, he found himself, his existence. And this is precisely what the fellow said. He said, "You know, when I was able to run, I didn't know where I was running to. And when I was able to move my hands and do, I didn't know what I was doing. But now that I can't do all that, now I really know. Now I really know." And so it's like I'm forced into confronting the meaning of my existence as existence. And it's very powerful. Very, very powerful. And this is the difference between dignity and redemption. I realized it once when I first met Mr. Kirk Douglas. Now, I didn't know, you know, you're thinking about this man, he's very famous, and he's in the ladder of dignity, you know, it's amazing. I'm amazed what fame is. Not that I'm amazed with fame, but But when I saw what it means, when I would spend some time with them. Anyway, so I went to the King David Hotel, and waiting there in the lobby, and you wonder, what's this guy going to look like? What's he going to sound like? Out of the elevator comes Kirk Douglas, and I don't believe it. He's wearing thick sunglasses. These dark sunglasses. And I thought, I can't believe this. I mean, you always hear about these Hollywood people wearing the sunglasses, and I thought, I don't believe it. And I can't see his eyes. And so, oh, nice to meet you, Rabbi. Oh, it's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Douglas. You, Mrs. Douglas. All right, fine. So we're going to go to the Kotel. It's just before Shabbat. And we get in a cab, get to the old city. I'm going to give Mr. Douglas a bit of a tour. We're going to go on the rooftop of Israelite, talk a little bit. The whole time, he's wearing these dark sunglasses. All right, fine. But now the sun is setting, and it's getting darker and darker. And you know, when the sun is out, you can wear sunglasses, but when it's dark, you kind of wonder what's going on. All right, now we walk down towards the Kotel, and now it's nighttime, and he's still wearing these dark sunglasses. And as we come closer to the Western Wall, all these people come up and say, Shabbat Shalom, Mr. Douglas! Oh, welcome home, Mr. Douglas! And I thought, this is so funny. You know, well, I don't say anything, and I did my prayer, and then afterwards we're walking out of the little cave there, whatever, and as we're walking out, another guy comes up and he says, oh, Mr. Douglas, such a pleasure to meet you. Oh, and welcome, Mr. Douglas. So as we're walking away from the Kotel, I looked at him and said, gee, those glasses don't seem to help. People recognize you. And he said something that was so deep and so beautiful, very touching. He said, I don't wear these glasses so people won't recognize me. I wear these glasses so that I won't have to make eye contact with all these people. And I went, what? He said, you see, as long as I have these glasses, I don't have to make that contact with all these people and have my privacy invaded by all these strangers looking at me. And then at that moment, he took off his sunglasses. He says, now we're relating. And I tell you, that was like a shock. You know, the first time after, this has already been like an hour and a half of discussion with all these sunglasses. And that time, it was from, it, before those sunglasses went down, it was David Aaron speaking to Kirk Douglas. But the moment he took those sunglasses off, there is that moment, a redemptive moment. We made eye contact. When I say eye contact, I don't mean E-Y-E. I mean eye contact. And that's redemption. That's redemption. And I think, you know, I realize people who are very famous and have achieved dignity probably have a very heightened awareness and appreciation of the need for redemption. You know, as long as you think you want dignity, dignity, so you're running after it. But when you finally achieve such lofty dignity, very often you're very free to address the real issue of, well, so who am I? And what is my worth? Like I told you the story yesterday about this multi-billionaire who's so famous and so successful, an achiever of achiever, building his company all over the world. And when I asked him, how do you feel? When you're in that plane going from place to place, he says, I feel lonely. I feel lonely. And so redemption comes, he says, when one feels worthwhile in terms of their existence, legitimate and adequate, anchored in something stable and unchangeable. Everything else is not stable. I could lose my car, I could lose my house, I could lose... But will I lose my eye? And that, is my eye anchored in something stable? Right? And this is the plague of modern men because so many people have placed so much faith in technology. But technology is on one hand very exciting, it gives you a sense of power. But imagine you just invested $2,500 into the state-of-the-art video. You're feeling really good. You've got it. You've made it. And as you're walking down the street, the first day you have it, you see somebody else with another video that makes your video look like a toy. And you say, where did you get that? You said, oh, this is the latest of the latest. It's only coming out in Japan, but I was in Japan and I got it. And you realize that within the next 2 weeks, that new video is going to be all over the market. You will not be able to sell your video. You very soon might not even be able to find parts to your video. And you feel so insecure because you can't keep up with the Joneses. And so there's this tremendous insecurity that goes on. But redemptiveness is an inner security which one experiences when they experience their being anchored in some eternal, infinite, ultimate being, which is what we call God. Cathartic redemptiveness, in contrast to dignity, cannot be attained through man's acquisition of control of his environment, but through man's exercise of control over himself. If you want to feel redeemed, a real sense of legitimacy in your existence, then you're going to demonstrate self-control. Why do people overeat? It's not because they're hungry. And it is because they're hungry. What are they hungering for? They're not hungering for food. They're hungering for substance. They feel a lack of substance. Now remember, we talked about what substance is. Substance is substance. That which stands beneath it all. That kind of essential. That is beneath it all. And I'm feeling a lack of substance. And so, and I've got this emptiness inside. This emptiness inside. And it's all forms of addiction because it's coming from this tremendous, tremendous emptiness inside. And so self-control has to do with a tremendous sense of self-worth. I deserve to treat myself better. It's like, you know, you have the famous saying, love your neighbor as yourself. I've met lots of people, I prefer they not love me that way. Please love me much better than that. Because that's the sad thing. It's a sense of my worth. Just my mere existence is valuable. And therefore, when something is valuable, you take care of it. And you wouldn't do anything that would be damaging. A redeemed life is ipso facto a disciplined life. But a person who doesn't have discipline, this is a person who's all over the place. They have no inner substance. The wind blows them in any direction because they're not anchored, right? And part of demonstrating anchoredness is discipline. But I don't feel anchored because I'm chasing rainbows all the time. Because I'm hoping that if I have this, or if I achieve this, or if they acknowledge me there, I'm going to feel like I am. And yet, I don't. Because that was dignity, and that was good, and that was important. But that was not redemptiveness. While a dignified existence is attained by a majestic man who courageously surges forward and confronts mute nature, a lower form of being, in a mood of defiance, redemption is achieved when humble man makes a movement of recoil and lets himself be confronted and defeated by a higher and truer being. Now this doesn't sound good to our Adam One side. Defeated? What do you mean? Redemption comes through a kind of defeation. What does that mean? I recoil, I'm confronted by a higher and truer being, which is what we call God. God is the higher, truer being. There's a tremendous, tremendous sense of inner joy in surrender. There's a tremendous sense of joy in assertion and power and control. But there's also tremendous drive to let go. I mean, When people go to places like the Grand Canyon, and they just sit, and they just open their eyes so wide, and they say, ah, because they're in ah. What does one feel in that moment? They don't feel control. They're not looking to control this environment. They're not trying to figure out, how can I cut these trees down, and how can I build myself a new yacht? Rather, they are seeking for an experience whereby they feel insignificant. Whereby they feel like a drop of dew on one of the millions of leaves that surrounds them. And that is actually a wonderful experience. What's so wonderful about it? Because I experience my existence merged with a greater existence. And I participate in that sense of greatness because I have merged and become one with that greatness. Do you follow? That's surrender. I'm not trying to control this. I'm trying to just... I basically put myself down as a sacrifice, and I tell this Foros, take me. Make me yours. I want you to digest me. Right? I don't want to eat this forest. I want this forest to eat me. I want to become one with this forest. That is the natural person who's running out there and wants to put themselves in a little rubber dinghy and paddle out to the middle of the ocean and then just throw their hands open and say, take me. I'm just another drop. And what's so joyous about it? Because I'm a drop in this incredible ocean. And my existence is experienced as a spark of this true, high, ultimate existence. Wow. It's a phenomenal experience. It's like the experience that you might remember if you spend time at rock concerts. But when you're at a rock concert, and then all of a sudden everybody is holding a little match. Right? Ever been in a rock concert where everybody, only rabbis go to these rock concerts? Right? And there you are, and you're looking around, and all of a sudden you turn around and you see thousands and thousands of little flames. And you feel like, ooh, I gotta get a match, I gotta get a match. Is it, you know? And you go, hey, buddy, got a match? You know? Hey, could you, hey, you know? And then finally, somebody gives you a match, and you go, there you are standing there with this little tiny flame. Isn't that so self-effacing? So why do you do that? And then you see the flame coming closer and closer to your finger, and you realize they all have lighters. And you're even more stupid. I mean, what am I doing here? What am I doing here with this little flame in my hand? Because I want to feel part of that great torch. And that gives me a sense of my ultimate existence as part of a greater existence. It's not control, it's not power, it's feeling controlled. And there's a great joy in that because I feel in a state of surrender that I have bound myself up with this ultimate existence, which we call Hashem, we call God. And so he says, while dignified existence is attained by a majestic man, he says there's a humbleness. Redemption is achieved when humble man makes a movement of recoil and lets himself be confronted and defeated by a higher and truer being. God summoned Adam the first to advance steadily. Adam the first is running out there and he's going to conquer the world. Adam the second retreats, he pulls back, right? Adam the first, he's told to exercise mastery and to fill the earth and subdue it. Adam the second is to serve. The secret of service. What does it really mean to serve God? What's so great about serving in contrast to being served? Well, there's something great about being served too. But there's also something great about serving. Because when I serve, I merge with the one I serve. And there's a tremendous feeling there. Right? There's a tremendous feeling there. You want to serve. It's natural for the human being to want to serve a greater reality. Not serve because functionally we will all achieve, but serve because existentially I will experience myself as bound up with the greater self, or a greater self. And it's a fantastic experience. And therefore, Adam too is placed in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it, to keep it. He's not in this garden to build skyscrapers. That's Adam 1's side. But the Adam 2 side is in the Garden of Eden, this paradise, and I'm just to cultivate it. But the word lavdo means to serve it. I become part of it by serving it and guarding it. And therefore, Adam 2 seeks to be a servant. Adam 1 seeks to be a master. But Adam 2 seeks to be a servant of a greater whole. Because through being a servant of this greater whole, he becomes one with this greater whole. This is so critical to understand because this is the meaning of mitzvot. When a person comes to understand Torah and mitzvot, there are a lot of things in there that just don't seem very practical. I mean, if you were here for Sukkot and you saw all these people holding these palm leaves with these myrtle branches and willow branches and this lemon-looking etrog, and they're standing there and they're shaking it back and forth, anybody watching them would say, they're crazy! I mean, what are you guys doing? What do you exactly think you're accomplishing? It looks crazy! You know? Can you give me a practical reason why I should do this? And the answer is, I'm not seeking to achieve. I'm seeking to feel redeemed. And when a person does mitzvot, they've got to ask themselves, what exactly are the mitzvot directing themselves to? Some mitzvot direct us to the majestic side, the majestic man. But others, some mitzvot direct us towards this achievement of dignity. But many mitzvot direct us to the experience of redemption through service, through doing the will of God, through anchoring my existence in a divine existence. And that's why when technological man looks at the man of faith, he thinks he's crazy. He thinks he's wasting his time. Because he doesn't understand that I'm not trying to achieve dignity by doing this. I'm looking for redemption, personal redemption. I'm looking to anchor my being in an ultimate being. I'm looking to enjoy my will with a universal, divine, transcendental will. I'm looking to plant my transience into the ground of eternity. Oh, it's a different thing. Dignity is acquired by man whenever he triumphs over nature. Man finds redemption whenever he is overpowered by the creator of nature. The man of dignity seeks to triumph over nature. But the man who's looking for redemption finds it when he feels overpowered by the creator of nature. You feel so overpowered when you're in that Grand Canyon. You feel, what a creator! I could never do this! But I am this. And because I am this, I am one with the one who created all this. Wow. That's a whole different scene. And therefore, dignity is discovered at the summit of success. Redemption in the depth of crisis and failure. When does redemption really hit? Because when I'm failing, I feel like, ugh, look what I did. How could I have done that? And so what am I left with? At that point, I am confronted with my I am-ness. And therefore, there's tremendous opportunity when we're defeated. Tremendous opportunity when we're in crisis. Because it forces us to look at I And at that moment, Mimamakim Krasicha Hashem, out of the depths have I called you God. I am calling out to God, but what right do I have to call out to God? I have failed. I have sinned. What right do I have to call? Is my calling legitimate? If you exist, your calling is always legitimate. And that is one of the most beautiful things about Judaism. Most beautiful thing about Judaism is no matter how low you think you have fallen, no matter how wicked you think you have behaved, it is legitimate to call out to God. And it's legitimate. And God will answer. Right? That's what it says. God will answer all those who truly call out. All those who truly call out. God doesn't say, well, listen, he has not fulfilled my commandment. She has not done my mitzvot. Well, I'm not going to answer back. If a person calls, but I'm saying call from a deep, deep place. Call from the deepest place, from my most substantive point, my I, as a spirit, as a spark of God. Then I can call out and God will answer. The Bible has stated explicitly that Adam the second was formed from the dust of the ground because the knowledge of the humble origin of man is an integral part of man's I experience. Adam the second has never forgotten that he's just a handful of dust. You know, one Hasidic Rebbe said, you know, you have to have two things in two different pockets. In one pocket you have to have a diamond. In another pocket, you have to have another a piece of dirt. And sometimes, depending on the situation, you're going to need, and you should reach into that pocket with the diamond and grab hold and remember, I'm a diamond. And sometimes, when you're feeling really haughty and you're feeling so powerful, that's when you should reach into the pocket with the dirt and say, remind me, but I'm still a piece of dirt. And therefore, I really need to challenge myself, what is the source of my value? What is the source of my value? And this is one of the major questions people ask. I think so much of life revolves around this. But Judaism says, if God blew into you the breath of life, the source of your value is God. And as long as you have that breath, the truth is, as long as you are that breath, because you don't have that breath, you are that breath, then you are valuable. Because you participate, you are an aspect of an absolute reality. And the more you can make that connection, and the more you can anchor yourself in that consciously, the more you are relieved, and you experience this cathartic redemption. So let's read on. And defeated must Adam the second feel the very instance he scores his greatest success. Now our Soloveitchik is going to talk about what is his greatest success. The greatest success of redemptive man, the man of faith, the one who seeks his eye, is when he goes out in the world and he starts naming the animals. And defeated must Adam the second feel the very instant he scores his greatest success. The discovery of his humanity, his I identity, the I awareness which he attains as the result of his untiring search for a redeemed, secure existence, brings its own antithesis to the fore. The awareness of his exclusiveness and ontological incompatibility with any other being. Man goes out and he's feeling this loneliness because of the deep, intense sense of I. He's feeling that incredible loneliness, right? And so he goes out to greet the world. Make a friend, not a business partner. And yet, all of a sudden he realizes how he is incompatible with every other being in this world. Remember, Adam 2 is created by himself, so to speak. He doesn't have a partner. Adam 1, man and woman, he created them. Adam 2 is talking about a man who's created and goes out into the world And now he looks at these animals. With the redeeming daybreak of a new identity, right? A new I identity, Adam II is ushered into a world of diversity and change, where the feeling of insecurity expresses itself. Now listen to these sentences. The feeling of insecurity expresses itself in the fact that the term man clothes a wondrous, unique, and incommunicable reality. In the gazing into somebody who returns one's gaze suspiciously, in watching and being watched in bewilderment. And that's frightening. You know? You walk down the street with a big smile and you say to somebody, "Hi!" And they look at you like, "What do you want from me?" "I want nothing. I'm just saying hi." "Sure." And you can't get that reciprocal glance of just friendship, of just eye to eye, with no ulterior motives, without any functional considerations. And so this man who's this wondrous, unique, incommunicable reality gazes. You go to a zoo, and you look in the eyes of these animals, and they just don't look at you. And they look at you, but they don't make eye contact. You know? And that's so different. And that's what Adam II needs. That's his redemption. And so, Adam II is still lonely. He separated himself from his environment, which became the object of his intellectual gaze. In other words, Adam II is not looking for an object of intellectual gaze. What he's looking for? He's looking for a subject to exchange an emotional glance. You can gaze at these animals, but it's just something in the eyes. And the man gave names to all the beasts and to the fowls of the heavens and to every animal of the field. He is a citizen of a new world, the world of man, but he has no companion with whom to communicate. And therefore he is existentially insecure. Right? Adam 1, what makes Adam 1 insecure? That I might lose all this. That I might fail. Right? Adam 2 is not afraid of failing in terms of accomplishments. Adam 2 is looking for communication. Communication. And when he doesn't have communication, then he's existentially insecure. Right? If Adam 1 doesn't have somebody to work with, so he's functionally insecure. Follow? But when Adam 2 has nobody, he's not looking for somebody to work with, he's working for someone to communicate with. And if I can't find someone I can communicate with, I feel existentially insecure. Why? Because I'm so lonely, because essentially I am incommunicable. That's what he just said before. The man is a wondrous, unique, and incommunicable reality. Why am I, on one hand, incommunicable? On the other hand, I'm looking for communication. I'm incommunicable because I'm unique. And because I'm unique, what can I say? The only way we communicate is by using shared terms. But when I say love, it's not what you think. It has certain similarities. But it's so particularly to me. And it's so particularly to you. There is communication at all possible. I'm feeling insecure because existentially I feel so lonely. And so I'm looking for someone to communicate, but can I really communicate? So he's going to talk about what it takes to communicate. But this brings us back to what we said the other day, which is, you're looking for someone you can communicate. That's your spouse. You're looking for not someone who you can work with, and who you can, so to speak, live with. You're looking for someone who you can exist with and communicate to. You're looking to someone who you can share your pain, your doubts. You're looking for someone who you can cry in their presence and not feel like they're going to judge you and say, "Oh, what a failure. oh, I can't believe it, I thought you were in control. And therefore, neither would the availability of the female who was created with Adam the first have changed this human situation. In other words, the wife of Adam 1 would never have satisfied Adam 2. Because the wife of Adam 1 is a co-worker. And Adam 2 is looking for a being who is of his own essence. And so a new emergence has to happen. A new companionship. At this crucial point, if Adam is to bring his quest for redemption to full realization, he must initiate action leading to the discovery of a companion. Even though as unique and singular as he will master the art of communicating and with him form a community. That's what I'm looking for. Someone who can communicate, right? So I can make a community. However, this action still is part of the redemptive gesture, must also be sacrificial. Now here comes another key phrase. Right? Man of faith is looking for redemption. Redemption comes through communication, existing with another person, companionship. And redemption comes through sacrifice. Why? The medium of attaining full redemption is again defeat. This new companionship is not attained through conquest, but through surrender and retreat. And the eternal God caused an overpowering sleep to fall upon the man. Adam was overpowered and defeated. In his defeat, he found his companion. How do you find your companion? What you need to do is sacrifice. What do you sacrifice? He says, you give of yourself to another. You have to give away a part of yourself. And that's how you become companions. You give away a part of yourself to another person. And then your companions, why? Because that person has you in them also. You've invested yourself in them. And therefore you merge with this person. And therefore you're looking for a companion, not in terms of what they can do for you, but in terms of what you can do for them. How you can serve them, how you can invest your I-ness in them, and that will be the glue, so to speak. And to that extent, you will be able to communicate. In terms of redemption and communication and companionship, it's not by giving gifts, although that's very nice, right? It's by giving yourself. It's by giving yourself to this person. You know, I remember when I was a kid, one of the most special times was when my mother would sit there and I'd be lying in my bed and she would read to me Winnie the Pooh. It's one of my special memories. Why? I mean, lots of things happen in childhood. I remember lying there, a little kid, my mother's reading to me Winnie the Pooh. Especially my mother's from Eastern Europe, so she has this sweet accent. She'd go, Winnie the Pooh, you know. So I grew up with Winnie the Pooh. And why was that so special? Because I knew that my mother was there for me. She wasn't reading Winnie the Pooh because she was getting something out of it. I never saw my mother read Winnie the Pooh when it wasn't to me. You know, as if she wanted to read it anyways. She read Winnie the Pooh for me. She gave me her being. She gave me her presence. And this is one of the sad things in the world. People don't know how to give their presence. They try to substitute it by giving presents with a T. I'll buy the kid a gift. Oh, no problem, sweetheart. Very sad. Very, very sad. I remember someone I know, their kid was selected to put the mezuzah up on the door of the school. So she said to her husband, you know, sweetheart, it's really important you be there. He said, oh, you know, I got this business deal. I'm so busy, sweetheart. I can't make it to that. Oh, it'll mean a lot. It'll really mean a lot to our son. So I'll buy him that bicycle he always wanted. I'll buy him that bicycle he always wanted. sorry. Sorry. That kid just wanted you to be there. He wanted you to share your being. And he didn't want a bicycle. And then we try to convince these kids that you do want a bicycle. That's what will make you happy. Right? Because toys are us. And they're not. And now I might be sued for that, right? But that's the problem. Toys are not us. We are us. And the more you give of your being to another, the more you have companionship, the more you feel that closeness. Again, the contrast between the two Adams come into focus. Adam the first was not called to sacrifice in order that his female companion come into being. The first man was created at the same time with the woman. They were both created at the same time. But in the second situation, Adam has to give away a part of himself in order to find a companion. You have to give away a part of yourself to find a companion. And then that companion is a part of yourself. Unless you're ready to allow that person to be part of yourself, unless you're willing to give of yourself in such a way that they'll be part of yourself, then you will be losing the meaning of your redemption. And so, the community fashioning gesture of Adam the first is, as I indicated before, purely utilitarian, intrinsically egotistical. The community Adam one is basically egotistical self-interest. That's what it is. It's functional, it's utilitarian. How can I use you? And in that world, sacrifice doesn't make any sense. Sacrifice. What am I going to sacrifice? Right? But Adam the second, communicating and communing are redemptive sacrificial gestures. Right? I'm sacrificing myself by giving it to you. But I'm ready to do that. Because. If I said because why, then I'd miss the point. Because. Thus in crisis and distress, there was planted the seed of a new type of community, the faith community. And that's why God introduces man to all these animals. Because until man realized, I'm incompatible with these beings on an ontological level. My being is so different from their being. He could have looked at these animals and said, gee, that horse, me and that horse, we could go places. Right? Me and that elephant, we could uproot things. Right? It's like in the Flintstones where everything is an animal instead of a machine. So you've got like, you know, their record player underneath is this little bird running, right, to keep this record player going. Sir, I could have created a world with all these animals. I could have created a work community with all these animals. But when I'm sitting beside Rover and I look in his eyes, nothing happens. Just nothing happens. And so in this crisis and distress when I realize that I'm more than what I do, when I realize that I'm seeking more than simply majestic dignity, but I'm seeking a redemptiveness, a real sense of existence, anchored in some greater eternal existence, I seek to merge with the other pieces of existence, the other aspects of existence. And therefore we have a new community called the faith community. So now Rav Soloveitchik gives us two kinds of community. One community is, he calls the natural work community, and another community he calls the covenantal faith community. And I think most people are not familiar with the covenantal faith community, which is what Judaism is in many ways uniquely about. So in the covenantal faith community, when in a natural community, when they read the word, it's not good that man is alone, that means it's not good that he's alone because he needs somebody to work with. Right? But in the faith community, when it says it's not good that man, it doesn't say it's not good that man be alone, but rather they translate that verse to mean it's not good to be lonely. Therefore, the covenantal faith community, in contradistinction to the natural work community, interprets the divine pronouncement, it is not good for man to be alone, not in a utilitarian, but ontological terms. In terms of the nature of being. It is not good for man to be lonely, not alone, with emphasis upon the to be. Being at the level of faith community does not lend itself to any equation. To be, this is I underlined, to be is not to be equated with to work and to produce. To be doesn't equal anything, right? It is what it is. And therefore, as historical materialism wants us to believe, for historical materialism, to be is to work, all right? To be is not identical with to think, as the classical tradition of philosophical rationalism throughout the ages, culminating in Descartes and later in Kant, tried to convince us. I think, therefore I am. And if I don't think, then I am not. And if I kind of feel dumb, right? If the more I think, the more I am? Or is there still, even if I don't think? So he's going to give us a definition of what to be is, and he gives us, you know, a selection throughout history of what people tried to deal with being. The value of being is the value of being, right? Because I convert it into work? Is the value of being because I convert it into thought? Is the value of being, like Schopenhauer says, is because I've suffered, therefore I have the right to exist because I've suffered? Or enjoying the world of sense in accordance with ethical hedonism? You know, being is enjoying, being is pleasure, being is consuming. No, to be is a unique, in-depth experience which only Adam II is aware. It is unrelated to any function or performance. That's what being is. To be means to be one and only, singular and different, consequently lonely. That's what it means to be. To be is to get in touch with my singleness, my unique I-ness. And at that point, if I've really achieved that, then all of a sudden I feel lonely. In my greatest moment of achievement, in this level of being, I reach my greatest moment of defeat, which is, but now that I know that I am so uniquely, so incommunicably, I am, then I am lonely. And when you have tasted your loneliness, you have tasted your I am-ness, and then you're ready for the answer, which is redemption, which is through companionship, which is through existing together, which is through sacrificing and giving away a part of yourself to somebody else, not in terms of function and not in terms of money and not in terms of gifts, but in terms of giving yourself to another person. And that becomes a tremendous, tremendous feeling that what I have of greatest worth is myself. And that's really what kids want from parents. That's what spouses want from each other. They want you to give yourself to them. I remember, boy did I learn this lesson. I was traveling, I was 2 weeks away from home, I was giving lectures all over the world, majestic man was out there conquering. I came home and I said to the kids, I said, let's go out. Abba's home, let's go out. Great. We're walking out of Jaffa Gate, we're walking into town. I said to the kids, I said, so what would you like, Chinese or Italian? We're going out to dinner. You know, in Israel, nobody goes to Israeli, you know, gourmet falafel, no such thing, right? So he said, what do you want, Chinese or Italian? At that moment, my son Ananiel, at the time, was 5 years old. He looked at me and said, I want you. Boy, I tell you, I heard a rip my heart. And I realized that's all he wants. He doesn't want to go anywhere. He just wants to be with me. And you know, sometimes you plan these fantastic vacations. Yes, 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 we're going to Disney World. And you're going to have popcorn and candy floss. And you're going to have Coke and hot dogs. And you're going to vomit all over me. And we're going to have fun on these rides. And we're going up and down and all around. And boy, you're going to have a great time. All right? But you know, you get there. And the father says, so have a good time. And I'll see you and meet me at 3 o'clock at the front gate. And the kid looks at you with such sad eyes. Hey, I thought we were coming here to be together. I thought we were coming here to be together. And that's what I want you to give me. I want you to give me your being. I don't want you to give me popcorn, although I like it. But I want you to give me your being, your presence. And so until I felt that, I'm not ready to give it. And I'm probably not ready to receive it either. And so, says, to be means to be one, only, singular, different, consequently lonely. For what causes man to be lonely and feel insecure if not the awareness of his uniqueness and his exclusiveness? What gives you the sense of loneliness? Here's his definition. The I is lonely, experiencing ontological incompleteness and casualness, because there's no one who exists like the I, and because the modus existentiae of the I cannot be repeated, imitated, or experienced by others. And therefore, my I cannot be repeated, my I cannot be imitated, my I cannot be experienced by others. So I feel lonely when I really access, when I don't access it, as when I really intuit and come to the I. Since loneliness reflects the very core of the I experience, and it's not an accidental modus, no accidental activity or external achievement, such as belonging to a natural work community and achieving cooperative success, can reclaim Adam the second from the state. I'm in the state of loneliness, and I don't matter how many people I'm working with, I don't matter how many people in this factory, I'm alone. I'm alone. Soloveitchik gives an example of a person walking through Times Square, New Year's Eve. Hey! Ha-ha! Hey, good to see you! Comes home, closes the door, and feels so lonely. Because after I said hello to everybody, nothing happened. Nothing really happened. We didn't bond. We didn't connect. We didn't really make eye contact. And eye contact, remember, is spelt with an I. And therefore, I repeat, Adam the Second must quest for a different kind of community. The companionship which Adam the Second is seeking is not to be found in depersonalized regimentation of the army, in the automatic coordination of the assembly line, or in the activity of institutionalized soulless political community. His quest is for a new kind of fellowship, which one finds in the existential community. There's the work community and the existential community. Here, Rav Soloveitchik gives a fantastic definition of an existential community. There, not only hands are joined, but experiences as well. There, one hears not only the rhythmic sound of the production line, but also the rhythmic beats of hearts starved for existential companionship and all-embracing sympathy, and experiencing the grandeur of the faith commitment. Wow. That's what I want to hear. The heartbeat. The heartbeat. There, only there, one lonely soul finds another soul tormented by loneliness and solitude, yet unqualifiedly committed. And that's what you're looking for. Commitment. There's no commitment in the work community. We work together as long as we produce together. If we don't produce together, it's conditional living, right? But in the faith community, in the existential community, in the community where people are listening for heartbeats, people are looking for genuine fellowship. That's unconditional. That's unconditional. And that is really the answer, so to speak, for this lonely man of faith. And now we'll just conclude. At this point, the main distinction between the natural community of Adam the first and the covenantal faith community of Adam the second becomes clear. You've got the natural community, you've got the covenantal faith community. And that's what's uniquely special about a Torah community. Or what a true Torah community will be, and I'll explain a distinction that Rav Soloveitchik makes between a covenantal community and a religious community. He says they're actually different. I'll get to it in a second. Right? The first is a community of interest forged by the indomitable desire for success and triumph, and consisting at all times of two grammatical personae. The I and the thou, who collaborate in order to further interests. So the key words are success, triumph, collaborate, interests. That's the key words of a natural community. All right? A newcomer upon joining the community ceases to be the anonymous he and turns into a noble, communicative thou. I can communicate with you. Get that, bring that, we'll do that. Okay, we can communicate in the natural work community. It's technical words. But it's not heart language. The second is a community of commitments born in distress and defeat. Two lonely people who are lonely because they've really confronted the exclusive, unique, incommunicable I seek to give of themselves to another and merge. The second is a community of commitments born in distress and defeat and comprises three participants, I, thou, and he, capital H. The he in whom all being is rooted and in whom everything finds its rehabilitation and consequently redemption. You know, what does it say in the Torah? It says, love your neighbor as yourself. That everybody knows. Most people do not know what it says after that. It says, ahavta l're'echa kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, ani Hashem, I am God. What does that got to do with it? How is it possible that I can love my neighbor because I am God and both of you exist anchored and rooted in my eternal and all-embracing being? And therefore the faith community, therefore the loneliness can only happen because where can we truly meet? In God. That's where we truly meet. I, lonely I, unique I, your lonely I, your lonely, unique I, exist within a continuum called the divine I, the great self. And that's why Judaism says, that's what Judaism claims, that if you take a woman and a man, so the word for woman is Isha, Aleph Yud Shin Hey, the word for man is Ish, Aleph Yud Shin. What do they share? They share two letters, Aleph and Shin, which spells fire. Right? What is the difference between them? Is the woman has a hey and the man has a yud. So we're taught in Kabbalah that what enables these totally unique beings to merge, it's the yud and the hey, the name of God, which is the name of God. Yud and hey is one of the names of God. It's that existential one that is enabling these two opposites to merge, to find each other, and to anchor. And therefore, love your neighbor as yourself. How can I do that? What will be the glue? What will be the continuum? It's the he, and therefore he in whom all being is rooted. And therefore, my unique being and your unique being is rooted in this ultimate being which we call God, and whom everything finds its rehabilitation and consequently redemption. There's redemption because I have discovered my worthiness. I have discovered my legitimacy because I exist like God exists. Wow. I exist because God has shared an aspect of his being with me. And therefore, Adam the first met the female all by himself. I don't need God to meet her. We're partners. I can figure out who functionally will fit me. And we'll be able to join forces with this common goal to build and to conquer. But who needs to introduce me to my companion? God. That's the second man. God needs to introduce me to my companion. I want God to be, so to speak, my chaperone when I go out. Because only in the context of an ultimate, absolute being will these two beings have ultimate, absolute meaning and value. And in giving to each other, they will discover that oneness that they share. And therefore, though I didn't bring this in here, that's why the first man, we only know of the name Elohim. God is Elohim, is the one who created me, creating borders and boundaries. But God is Yud He Vav He, comes from the word to be, which we'll be talking about in greater length. And God is Yud He Vav He, is not only the God who created me. I experience Elohim as the God who created me. But when I experience Yud Ke Vav Ke, I experience the God who perpetuates me by sharing His ultimate being with me. Do you follow this? Sharing God's being. That's how I exist. God is, so to speak, sharing Himself with me. I exist within this divine being. And my being, it's not my being, because I am being, so to speak. And therefore, the second man has the name Yud Kei Vav Kei, because the second man gets in touch with being. And therefore, Adam the first met the female all by himself, while Adam the second was introduced to Eve by God, who summoned Adam to join Eve in an existential community molded by sacrificial action and suffering, and who himself became a partner in this community. God becomes a partner in this existential community. And so, what did we learn from this? I hope a tremendous amount. Question is, what will we internalize from this? There are two men, two humankinds. There is majestic man who is driven to conquer, to triumph, and to succeed, and to achieve a status of dignity, and that is valid. Now, valid, it is a divine mission to do, to build those hospitals, to build those transportation vehicles, to reach for the stars, to harness solar energy. That is creating the image of God. But then there's another side of me, and that's the faith side of me. That's the experience of that breath of God inside of me. That's the yearning for redemption, which is a sense of existential value, which is a sense of, no matter what I do, whether I fail, whether I succeed or fail, I'm worthy because I am. And I am because God is. There's one thing I mentioned I would tell you, that Rav Soloveitchik makes a distinction between a faith community and a religious community. He says that, you know, a majestic man can also join a religious community. And it's not a faith community. It's not an existential community. There's something pragmatically useful about being part of a religious community, right? There's something aesthetically pleasing to be part of a religious community. We're all in the synagogue together, we've got the sisterhood, and we have the brotherhood, and we have the synagogue functions, we meet a lot of people there, right? We make a lot of deals there, we talk business during davening sometimes. I mean, you know, a person could be in a religious community and still not be in an existential community, right? Because in this religious community, they have not really yet stripped themselves of their functions and stripped themselves of seeing this as a way to get ahead in the society, but rather see this as a community where our hearts beat together and where we can just simply sit together and just be together. And so I think that's another problem that I think people who are coming to Judaism have. They are looking for a faith community. They're looking for an existential community. They're looking for unconditional love. And they're looking for that sympathy, and they're looking for that eye connection. And yet sometimes they can be very disillusioned because they assume that, yeah, sure, here are people that are doing mitzvot, and here are people that are learning Torah. And that doesn't always guarantee that that person was involved in Torah from the perspective of Adam 2. But sometimes people learn Torah in an Adam 1 mode, right? Which is called learning Torah, lo lishma. It's learning Torah not for its true sake, but nonetheless, it's still valid. But it's important to make a distinction, right? So that you won't get disillusioned and understand, oh, this is this is not a faith community yet. This is a religious community where people have bound together out of a certain instinct for survival on the functional side. But I'm not saying that what you meet in Jerusalem is that. But sometimes you might meet that. But I do believe in Jerusalem, there's an opportunity, and I believe in many places in the world, to really taste the redemption, right, in what a Jewish community is ultimately about.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.